This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
The Lion's Eye Institute, located in a repurposed historic cigar factory in Tampa, Florida's Ybor City, is the world's first and only combined eye bank and ocular research center in the world. Come along and join me, Tom Wilmer, and correspondent Jennifer Simonson, for an insightful conversation with Jason Woody, president and CEO of the Lion's Eye Institute for Transplant and Research.
My name is Jason Woody, and I'm the president and CEO of the Lion's Eye Institute. We're here at our corporate office here in Ybor City. As far as a nonprofit program, we were looking for a place that would give us the opportunity to serve the community. Ybor City allowed for that. When this building came up for sale, we jumped right on it right away, and then we moved our corporate office here.
Lions is an international organization, correct?
It is. It's one of the largest service clubs in the world. Many people know that they really don't realize that the Lions Club, their vision side, was started actually by Helen Keller. And Helen Keller approached the Lions in the early 1920s as far as, you know, giving them a purpose, the Lions Club purpose. It would have been Oak Brook, Illinois. That's where the Lions was there. This was where she made the speech, was at their national meeting. And Helen Keller challenged them to be the Knights of the Blind in the Crusade Against Darkness. And that's where the Lions Club picked up their vision programs that have gone global. I think she laid down a pretty tough challenge, you know, with them, because she actually called them out as able-bodied men, you know, that are able to do this. Look how much I've been able to accomplish. She was born blind, deaf, and mute. What would you be able to accomplish being able-bodied? And I think many service clubs have a humble beginning like that of some to get started for their mission.
Give us an overview, a word picture of the Eye Institute here in Florida, and for a moment, the history of the building you're in. That's really fascinating.
You know, a little bit first about the building, and then we'll can talk about, you know, how we came here. But as far as the building was built roughly in about 1905, finished in 1907, used to be a cigar factory. There's roughly about 121 cigar factories in the Tampa Bay area, and now there's roughly about 11 left. People don't realize that Ybor City was the cigar capital of the world, not of the country, but of the world right here. In, you know,
that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and so there was more cigars produced here than any place else. As you said, there was many buildings that were here, historical like that. This one came up, as I mentioned earlier, had come up for sale, and we really wanted to find a way to move the Lion's Eye Institute here. You know, part of our program, we provide sight for people that are blind or visually impaired to over 80 countries around the world besides the U.S., and in this facility, we have a full surgical suite. We do everything but the transplant here. We actually talk to the families, send the team out, and actually do the recoveries and place those corneas with the waiting recipients.
And the harvest might take place anywhere across America or around the world?
The distribution will take place anywhere in Florida, anywhere in the country, anywhere. But the recovery, our cases, the recovery take place in Florida.
So that implies that the Eye Institute has other parallel facilities around America?
There's probably about 50 other what they consider eye bank. They're nationwide, and some states have a couple, some states have one. And we really work in a cooperative manner. Our ultimate goal is that no one has to wait for a corneal transplant.
But the Lions Eye Institute?
Probably out of the 50, probably about a dozen are Lions programs.
And are they similar? They do research?
Many of the Lions programs are on a much smaller scale. We're by far the largest Lions Eye Rank program in the country, if not probably in the world. You know, they're a smaller scale based upon their needs for the local community, so some may not need a facility as large as ours.
Very interesting. How do you get the word out?
Just like this. But the most important thing is I tell people that if you really want to have the opportunity to change someone, is register to be a donor. That's the first thing. Nothing that we do really happens without just that very generous gift of an individual or a donor's family. Everything you hear about from organ, bone, skin, eyes of that nature really came from a grateful family that offered that gift.
So you get a flag as soon as somebody, their death certificate is filed, right?
Not even their death certificate, as soon as they die. So there's a federal law that hospitals have to notify an organ procurement program or a tissue bank or an R bank at the time of death. So we're going to get that call usually sometimes within 10 or 15 minutes of the patient's expiring. At that time, we review their medical records to make sure they're healthy for research or for transplant, mostly for transplant purposes. Once we make that determination, if they're a registered donor, we can follow up for a recovery. If they're not a registered, then we opt to approach the family.
If you have a medical directive, that's one thing, but like you were talking to us earlier about your driver's license, talk to about that.
Yes, so when you go to get your driver's license, they ask you a host of questions, and somewhere in the mix in every state is, would you want to be an organ donor? And if you actually sign up and say yes, then that is obviously you're giving us permission to move forward that. If someone does not say yes, then we approach the family.
So if your driver's license says yes, there's a flag and you get an immediate call.
We get the call already, and then we actually cross-reference the DMV. So you want to verify the information. The patient passes away. Sometimes the nurses, the family will say he wanted to be a donor. We just don't take their word for it. We actually verify it with the DMV.
You can pull up their driver's license.
We verify that information. If they had not elected to be a donor, then we approach the family to get their consent.
Again, the funding comes from?
Well, as far as from public support, as I mentioned earlier, it's against the law to buy or sell human tissue. The only thing that you're able to have a recovery fee for is what they call a processing fee. The serologies, the transportation, the things of that nature. Most transplants are covered under Medicare, and private insurers, you know, cover them as well.
Talk to us about your partnership and relationship with university med schools.
We collaborate extensively with all the medical schools in Florida, and we partner with them for teaching, for training, for their young ophthalmologists, for their PhDs, their researchers. It's an intricate relationship and a very valuable, and we value their relationship as much as they value ours. And so we really want to play a strong role in the community. Many of the young doctors that they have going through their program will become physicians of ours in the future, and so we want to support their education and give them the best opportunity that we can.
Talk to us about your virtual learning lab. That's really cool.
So one of the things that we realized during COVID that people couldn't travel. So as many of us are somewhat confined, some now still confined, but for the last year and a half, but still people needed to learn or the need to learn. And so we actually have a virtual training center here that we actually can have one of our surgeons actually demonstrate a surgery here in our office, and we can have that simulcast around the country. They can be local surgeons can come in and do that. Many of people attempt, you know, as far as seeing different trainings on Zoom. So we really allowed the international, domestic and international training component to keep going even during these difficult times.
All right, I'm Jennifer. I'm here with Tom, continuing the interview. I think one of the cool things about this building is the amount of history that's here. Could you describe the building, kind of what it looks like and what each floor was used for back in the heyday?
So if you look at that, you know, the cigar factory, as far as that, we actually have roughly about a 30,000 square foot building, and there are three floors plus a basement. Many people don't realize that Florida buildings actually had a basement. It's something you'd usually hear in the north. Actually, the basement was actually for storing the tobacco. Remember, there was no refrigeration, so it had to be kept cooler. Florida has a very, you know, inclement warm weather, so tobacco was stored in the basement to keep it cool, and then there were rollers, the individuals, cigar rollers, on each floor. Sometimes there could be 200 or 300 rollers on each floor, and then they would roll the cigars, you know, from out. They were based upon skill there, so there were some floors maybe that had maybe a mid-level, high level, and then maybe a new roller there, and they were based upon that. Interesting enough also too is each of the floor had a lector. During that time, most of the cigar rollers did not have any formal education, but leaving here, the lector read the newspaper in Spanish, English, and Italian. So what happens is just by almost osmosis of being every day, you were having cigar workers that were leaving here with little or no education that were actually trilingual.
It seems like this community, it was really a melting pot of a lot of different cultures that actually interacted with each other quite well.
I think that it was really, to this day, different, but the same as a community that takes care of itself, take care of its own, that you know, really look at all the businesses work together, the community, as far as from that side, you know, back the time there was your doctor's offices, your grocery store, all of those things that you work together. You know, one of the first insurance companies, you know, were the Spanish, you know, as far as in the Cuban hospitals that were here, and they actually had a form of insurance there for cigar workers so the families could be taken care of, way ahead of before what we know now as an HMO or anything like that.
Interesting. Were there any other areas you were looking at as far as where you wanted to relocate when you did, and why did this particular building win out?
We were located in a wonderful part of Tampa, you know, near the airport, but it was very industrial. And if you're looking for individuals that are seeking assistance or charity assistance, it was maybe a little bit intimidating for them. You know, maybe it was have to park, you know, go up multiple flights of stairs, take an elevator there. And we said, where can we get something that's close to the community? You know, I've been here all my life that I realized that Ybor City was just that. And then we stumbled upon this building. This building came up for sale, and then, like I said, as soon as we walked through it once, we realized this would be our perfect home.
Did you guys have to do a lot of changes with the building once you moved in?
We did. It was basic office space here. So right now, that as we talked about earlier, the design of the building from where it used to be a cigar factory, we really had to make it high-end medical. So really, it looks nothing like that from the outside. It's a historic building when you pull in. We have cutting-edge science inside between our research facility, our transplant facility. So there's quite a bit of remodeling, extensive on the inside there. The exterior we wanted to keep to really just pay respect to the building, but the inside has been modified quite a bit, very similar to anything you would see in a modern medical building. I think that as far as, you know, with donation, we talked about this a little bit earlier, is that all loss of life is tragic, no matter what their age is. But what we have talked to the donor families, we've given them some sliver of hope that it just wasn't a complete loss to know that their loved one truly does live on in somebody else is impactful. And I can tell you the letters we get, they tell us that's the only good thing that happened. You know, when they lost a loved one, the only positive thing, the only little silver lining was, we know our loved one is now helping someone through sight, through donation, and that really to know that they're living on, doesn't matter where the gift went or who it went to, but they just feel in their heart that that's exactly, their loved one was a very caring person, and for them to extend that gift was very valuable to them.
Any silver lining in those kind of situations are probably, you know, appreciated.
They are. And then, of course, at the very other end of the spectrum is the recipient. Most all of our recipients had no control over the condition they're in. It was hereditary. It was by accident. It could be a fireman that needs skin. It could be, someone that had hereditary eye disease. You know, they had no control over that, you know, from that side. And so all they're doing is they're waiting for that generous gift and talking to recipients. They didn't want anything to happen to their donor. But they're so glad the individual or the family made a decision to think of somebody else like them to enhance or even in many cases save their lives.
That's great. Well, if somebody wanted to find out more about the Lions Eye Institute, where would they go?
The easiest, Lions Eye Institute, lionseyeinstitute.org. You can see all of our links to obviously on Facebook. And if they want to find out more information, Donate Life. You can look at theirs if you want to register to be an organ donor. You can go into the National Registry, and that registers you everywhere. It takes about 5 minutes. And also, too, if you actually have an Apple phone, which everybody has an iPhone, actually the organ donor app is actually under the health app there. So people don't realize, and it takes less than 5 minutes there. If you go into the health app right there, you can click on, takes about 5 minutes. It's verified and it's right there. So we have a huge thank you to Apple. Every iPhone that's out as far as that's made right now comes with that organ donor registry in it.
That's perfect. That makes it super, super easy. The Lions Eye Institute open to the public. Can somebody come and tour the place?
We have tours, people coming in just wanting to see the science. We are a STEM program as well for teaching and education to, you know, bring in young individuals as far as they want to have learning to learn about the science side. We also have donor families. Up to the front there, we have a memorial. Their water fountain, the water's off now, but as far as that, it's there for the front. Sometimes have a medical facility. People want to come in through training. So yes, it's an open facility. We're very proud of what we do. And of course, we invite all Lions Club members from around the country, around the world to visit us as well.
Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for visiting Ybor City.
Yeah, it's been really fun, so thank you.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, along with associate producer Jennifer Simonson, reporting from Tampa, Florida, where we've been visiting with Jason Woody, president and CEO of the Lions Eye Institute for Transplant and Research.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture, and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolff, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.